We are now at tape four, side B. A few thoughts before we begin this lecture. First from Leo Tolstoy. Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own peculiar way. From James Michener, as he writes in Life magazine. For young people, the home still ought to be the cradle of values. But unfortunately, a staggering proportion of them do not live in stable homes. It is thoughtless beyond imagination for older people to say rigidly, the child must learn his or her values at home, when there is no home. Some substitute must be found. Religious training? It would be wonderful if every child had a warm, comfortable experience I had in my Sunday school with its songs, its stories, its bag of candy at holidays. But many are denied that. And while religion is an admirable teacher for those connected to it, it is a silent voice for those who are not. And then this telling quote from a 15-year-old suburban church teenager. We don't really have a family. We just have four people who are making sure we all survive. And then in Rebuilding the Nest, David Blankenhorn, the editor, says, today, for example, nearly one child in four in the United States is born out of marriage, and the divorce rate in the United States is perhaps the highest in the world. Although the impact of this trend on adult happiness may be debatable, its impact on children's well-being is alarmingly clear. The mounting evidence of the harm done to children by divorce and unwed parenthood in our society is now become virtually unchallengeable. And finally, these words from a 15-year-old in a Chicago housing project. He says, if I grow up, I'd like to be a bus driver. I call this lecture Beyond the Cleavers, the challenge and opportunity of ministry to non-traditional families. One of the biggest occupational hazards for me in youth ministry is the telephone. Since the advent of the Do Not Disturb button on our church's phone system, I'm no longer a victim of calls that catch me at the wrong time. But more recently, my trouble with the telephone has not been the calls that come to me, but the calls that I make. I know better. I tell myself over and over again that I know better, but on a fairly consistent basis, I find myself with a phone in my ear and a foot in my mouth. I dial the right number and ask for the wrong people, like when I call the 12-year-old boy in the family by his sister's name. But over the past 10 years, my most classic phone faux pas, would that be a phone pas, has gone something like this. My call is to Collier Anderson. As I expect, Collier's not home, but I do get a mother on the phone, and I'm ready to seize the opportunity to build a little rapport with Collier's mom. I look down the list of parents' names in front of me to get her first name, and I respond pleasantly, professionally. This is Mark DeVries at First Presbyterian Church. Is this Mary? There's a long pause. There's an icy edge to her voice, and she answers, this is not Mary. Mary is Collier's father's new wife. I'm Betty Young. How may I help you? Talking around the size 10 shoe in my mouth, I leave a message and I fumble off the phone. Besides giving me a crash course in phone etiquette for the 90s, these kinds of conversations serve as a stark reminder of the increasingly complex home environments many of our teenagers grow up in. My first reaction to the growing number of young people in our church from non-traditional families was to create niche programming to reach different kinds of them. It all started with a 6-week divorce recovery course that went quite well, and I began to think of all the possibilities, blended family support groups, chemical dependency groups, or 12-step groups of every possible variety. I even started a group for teens who had just been kicked out of school. But after a year and a half of this diversified niche programming, I was exhausted, and I realized that this kind of strategy is simply unworkable for the long haul. First, this sort of something specific for everyone style of programming requires a hefty budget and extensive manpower to maintain, even if the number of teenagers participating in each group is limited. This single factor keeps most churches from seriously considering this approach to reaching young people from non-traditional families. Second, those churches that take this route will quickly discover that teenagers from similar non-traditional situations do not fit neatly into groupings that can be sustained. Third, many young people from non-traditional families already feel sensitive about being different. Emphasizing the different family, quote, problems may keep as many away as it attracts. And finally, it's next to impossible to design a program with enough niches for everyone in the group. Many young people will, by default, fall through the cracks. So family-based youth ministry is not, therefore, about creating special programming for young people from each different kind of family. What every teenager needs in order to grow in Christ is a faith-nurturing family or a faith-extended family, right? What every teenager needs is true especially for those from non-traditional families. This sort of need-centered programming may attract them to the youth program, but it usually is not enough to provide them with a foundational relationship with Christian adults that will lead them to spiritual maturity. Now, it's not all bad news. Without a doubt, families today are far different from what they were a generation ago. But the changes in the North American family are not completely negative. Clearly, families in our time face increasing threats to their survival, but these threats may, in fact, strengthen some families as significantly as they destroy others. In a recent Preparing for Adolescence class for parents of pre-teenagers, I began by asking the group, is it harder or easier being a parent now than it was for your parents? Initially, the response was unanimous, harder. Then one reflective father said, but my parents never had classes like these, and they needed them. It's harder for us, yes, but we've also gotten more opportunities to be trained, and we seem to be much more motivated to learn what we need to do differently. There is this renewal of interest in learning parenting skills, and most parents have a healthy awareness of how little they really know. The myriad of parenting materials available today only hints at the increasing desire that parents in the United States have to do their job well. Here's some good news. In addition to the Promise Keepers phenomenon that we talked about at the end of the last side. The end of the last decade, Mass Mutual American Family Value Study indicated that 81% of Americans view their family as a primary source of pleasure in their life. And another study, 84% of men named family as the most important facet of their lives. A recent Time Life survey documented that today's fathers are investing 4 to 5 times the amount of time educating 2 children as their fathers spent raising 5 children. Not only are parents more interested in the family, teenagers seem to be as well. One survey asked young people aged 13 to 15 what they really wanted in life. Their number one desire was for a happy home life. The teenage boys indicated they wanted this even more than teenage girls. 5,000 high school students were surveyed in the early 90s in World Almanac. The students were asked, "Who's your greatest hero?" You know what? Without even being included on the list of choices, Mom came in second and Dad came in fourth. In many ways, the more difficult and complex family life becomes, the more it seems to be valued by parents and children alike. So I consider working with families at this time in our history to be an unparalleled opportunity for ministry. Parents and their children are increasingly interested in finding ways to connect with each other. And these connections can be the most crucial ingredients in building the faith maturity in our young people that we're looking for. But on the other hand, it's not all good news. Developing a ministry to teenagers from non-traditional families can be exceedingly difficult. Several years after I arrived in Nashville, I decided to clean up our roles and find out the identity of the crowd I'd never met. What I found out was that the majority of the 50 young people who had been completely inactive from our youth program came from families that had recently experienced some kind of major change, like divorce, death, or remarriage. Recently, I've analyzed the relationship between a young person's family situation and the likelihood of his or her involvement in our program. I discovered that teenagers who are living with both their original parents are, I did it class by class, they are 2 to 6 times more likely to be involved in our church than young people who live with a single parent or with a step parent. The simple understanding is that when a teenager's family is in chaos, our creative newsletters and stimulating programs are simply not going to be enough. In this chapter, this lecture, I want to identify the particular challenges of teenagers that come from various types of non-traditional families, what kind of challenge they present youth ministry. The fact that I do not advocate special diversified programming to reach these young people does not mean that we can ignore the unique demands of each teenager's home situation. Non-traditional families present a challenge to every church, and in general, young people from these families will require more support and attention. Could that be 2 to 6 times more? More support and attention than young people from traditional two-parent families. Now, for most, this will simply be a review of types of non-traditional families. But before I dive into this discussion of the challenges of the different types, I do think it is important to acknowledge that there has been a great deal of confusion and misinformation handed out about using this term traditional. In many ways, people have said that the traditional family has died. And that is a fact that simply is not true. And I'd like before we talk about these non-traditional families, simply to acknowledge and do just a bit of conversation about traditional families. You may have heard one of the most quoted statistics about today's families. That is something like under 10% of families in America can now be defined as traditional. In 1989, Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut argued, "There are only 1 in 10 families today where you have a mom at home and a dad at work. Only 1 in 10. Ozzie and Harriet are gone." In a 1988 television interview, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder of Colorado asserted, "Only 7% of today's family fit the Ozzie and Harriet syndrome." In making her case for a national child care policy, she claimed that basing such a policy on traditional families was like saying the highway program must recognize people who don't drive. Well, like any compelling statistic, this one's been used by many who obviously are too busy to check their facts. The, quote, under 10% statistic is simply not true. According to the 1987 Bureau of Labor Statistics, traditional families, that is, father working, mother at home, account for more than one-third, the largest single category of all families with preschool children. Another 15.8% of families with preschool children can be classified as semi-traditional, with a father working full-time and a mother working part-time, sometimes as little as 10 hours a week. My wife, whose primary job is raising children, would not be considered part of a traditional family because she's worked one day a week doing child care in a Mother's Day Out program and did some telemarketing work from our home. When the statistics are added up, 49% of families with preschool children could still be seen as traditional. In other words, there's a good chance that a significant percentage of the youth we work with have grown up with and are growing up in traditional family settings. And there actually seems to be a growing desire among families to return to the traditional family model. In 1986, the Newsweek poll of working mothers discovered that only 13% of them said they actually wanted to work full-time. Similarly, a Washington Post survey indicated that 62% of working mothers would stay home with their children if they could afford to. In light of this reality, Stephen Bamey's conclusion to Rebuilding the Nest in a collection of essays that I've quoted repeatedly offers the needed balance as we design our ministry to changing families. He says, "Stable families, in turn, both provide opportunities for personal growth and hold the key to society's future through the socialization of children. For these reasons, we should be willing to assert our cultural preference for traditional norms such as marriage and a two-parent home, while at the same time accommodating and reaching out to those who have chosen to lead their lives within alternative settings." All that is to say, I think it's very important for us not to be duped into believing that the majority of families are non-traditional. Now, in some cultures, that is going to be the case, and it may be the case in your church. But to say that only less than 10% of our kids come from traditional families, which is a statistic that gets bounced around quite a bit, is not helpful, because anytime we deal with inflated facts rather than real facts, we end up creating ministries to programs that are simply not, to problems that are simply not clearly understood. So now let's talk about the different types of non-traditional families. I want to talk about divorce first. When my parents divorced, I was just beginning junior high. At that time, it was still odd for me to be one of the few students who did not have both parents. I can remember being embarrassed even to speak about it. But today, teenagers from divorced families seem to have a lot of company, and they can still feel tremendously alone. The divorce rate has begun to level out, but it has done so at an alarmingly high plateau. Approximately 50% of marriages that begin this year will end in divorce. And of couples who divorce, approximately 70% have children under 18. And interestingly, second marriages tend to do worse than first marriages. And third marriages, there's a higher divorce rate than there are for second marriages, and so on. Practically all recent studies of the effects of divorce on children indicate that there is, in the words of Andre Brooks, frequently a substantial period of emotional and practical child neglect following parental separation. The reasons are obvious. First, the parents are preoccupied with their own issues of grief and anger and have less energy to attend to the needs of their children. Second, the economic adjustments that divorce almost always requires can sap whatever nurture-giving energy a parent has left. The income for a single parent drops an average of 37% within the first 4 months of the divorce. Add to these reasons the chaos of a new routine of being transported from one home to another, and it becomes clear that children are often the biggest victims of divorce. The argument that divorce creates few problems for a child's long-term development is simply not consistent with the research in the field. Teenagers from divorced families often have extra demands placed on their time because of the multiple relationships that must now be maintained and because of adult-like responsibilities that must now be assumed. Because this time often competes with church time, it is important that our youth ministries not abandon the young people who may need us most simply because they're unwilling to participate or unable to participate regularly in our programs. In a recent extensive study of the effects of divorce on children, one fact stands out as a stark indictment to our churches. Under 10% of those children of divorce who were interviewed had any adult that spoke to them sympathetically as the divorce unfolded. Less than 10%. Single-parent families is the second type of non-traditional family. Approximately 1 out of every 10 households is headed by a single parent. Research also indicates that as many as 60% of children will spend some part of their childhood in a single-parent family. Often the more family-centered a church is, the more difficult it is for the single parent to find his or her place. When the majority of churches, groups, or classes are designed for couples, it's easy to understand why so many single parents simply drop out altogether. When these single parents drop out of the church, their children almost always stay at home with them. Although some single parents become incredibly intentional about bringing their children to church, many become sporadic in their own involvement, switching from one church to another many times in the span of a few years. This sort of inconsistency is particularly confusing for their children, who often choose to stay away from church rather than face the embarrassment of adjusting to a new group again. Blended families and step-parents. When the two girls walked into the room together, they were noticeably tense. I greeted the girl I knew, and I asked her to introduce me to her friend. With an irritated sigh, she announced, "This is not my friend. It's my dad's new wife's daughter." Stepsister was obviously too intimate. Teenagers from blended families often carry around a subterranean tension that is seldom spoken and frequently left unresolved. Confusion and lack of clarity about parental roles often leave these young people with a feeling of being displaced, even in their own families. The American Step Family Foundation reports that in 1990, one out of three children was living in a step family. These young people have an acute need for adult friends and the sort of identity that comes from being needed in the body of Christ. Chemical dependency. When a family member has a drug or alcohol problem, it obviously affects the other family members as well. Teenagers growing up in families with chemical problems almost always pick up some of those unhealthy relational patterns. The best hope for lasting change comes through sustained relationships with healthy adults who can help the young people see themselves and their family situation more clearly. And I hope you're seeing the trend here. Each of these non-traditional situations is so complex that we have to acknowledge that the impact of our traditional youth programming on kids coming from non-traditional families is going to be limited. What is going to have an impact is the lasting sort of connection they can have to significant other adults in the church. One way to help teenagers that come from homes with chemical dependency is to have preventative programming, such as sessions in the evening where we bring in special speakers. But by and large, those programs have somewhat of a limited influence. These prevention courses can be greatly enhanced by involving parents alongside their teenage children. The same is true about education about sexuality. There's real power in bringing a collection of adults to be there in the same class with the kids. Placing these programs in a parent youth setting has three primary benefits. One, parents, even the inactive parents, are concerned about these issues and are likely to attend and bring their children. Two, while parents are focused on their children's high-risk behavior, they may actually be more open to changing their own inappropriate behavior. And three, while we talk about the issue, we involve parents and their children in community-building experiences that help them to build an extended family. Okay, families for caring for aging grandparents. Many of the parents of teenagers will be feeling the squeeze of working, raising children, and caring for an aging parent at the same time. And like most non-traditional family arrangements, having a grandparent in the home is a good news, bad news proposition. While family benefits greatly from the grandparents' presence in the home, the parents, both of whom likely work full-time, find themselves increasingly exhausted with less energy to give to the intentional faith nurturing of their children. And kids in poverty. Approximately 12 million children in the United States live in poverty, many of them in crime-ridden housing projects. Adult males are often conspicuously absent, and mothers, when they are not working, are frequently clinically depressed. More often than not, the family structure has been destroyed, and the children grow up with an inordinately high accumulation of risk factors. Lewis Sullivan's description of the kind of ministry that works with teenagers in urban areas sounds remarkably similar to the priorities of family-based youth ministry. He says this, "It is time to remember that what has worked throughout our history as African Americans, a history of overcoming negative circumstances by the force of our character, and what worked was tight-knit families and strong neighborhoods supported by the community of faith." Well, it's certainly beyond the scope of this course, and certainly beyond my level of expertise, to speak in great detail about working with teenagers in low-income or poverty situations. But what I do know about working with children and teenagers in poor areas is that flash-in-the-pan youth programming has limited impact. The one determining factor for behavioral and academic success for young people from poor neighborhoods has always been the level of stability of their families or their connection to some durable, available adult, their connection with an extended family. And then the final type of non-traditional family I want to identify is both parents working in busy families. When both parents are working full-time outside the home, less energy, obviously, and time is available for nurturing activities like talking, family meetings, and eating together. In addition to parents working more hours away from their families, We have the increasingly hectic schedule of the children themselves to contend with. It is easy for busy teenagers to relegate their faith to the category of just another activity or another program to be added to their frantic lifestyle. Let's talk a bit about some strategies for reaching non-traditional families. Families suffering financial reversals, families in which one member has a long-term illness, or families with foster children, families with a parent in prison, families with children with special needs, and families with emotionally absent parents, all pull teenagers away from traditional youth programming. Realistically, no youth program can create a different educational program for each of the varying types of non-traditional families. So what can we do? Although the death of the traditional family has been frequently overstated, as I've suggested, the fact still remains that approximately half of the families in America can now be described as non-traditional. There is the young person from the single-parent family who's uncomfortable around a group of peers. There's the boy from the Christian traditional family who's been arrested for stealing. There's the student whose parents are getting divorced who carries his Bible to school. And there's the girl from the missionary family who makes fun of anything remotely Christian. No neat and simple patterns here. The most effective strategy for reaching these young people is to provide a consistent personal ministry to each teenager who's a member of the church, whether or not he or she ever attends. Admittedly, the building of this sort of personal mentoring program for each teenager requires a great deal of organization and follow-through, but probably not as much time as most of us spend on our big programs like Youth Week or the Big Fall Kickoff. Again, I think I've suggested previously Wayne Rice's and Miles McPherson's piece, their book, and then they have a video training curriculum to go along with it. It's called One Kid at a Time. And that's a program designed for building a mentoring program. As I suggested, I think, earlier, we had to change our mentoring program into a prayer partner program. We certainly have the dream of eventually connecting every one of our kids with a special adult friend in the church. At this point, it did become too overwhelming to try to coordinate a mentoring relationship between 200 youth and 200 different adults. The starting point, then, of ministering to a generation of families that's beyond the Cleavers is recognizing that professional youth staff cannot do this work alone. There's simply too many families with complex needs. Each requires time that's above and beyond anything a single staff person or program can handle responsibly. As a general rule, programming will not be the key to reaching these youth. Relationships must be built in which their unique situation is understood and taken seriously. The goal is to build an extended family for our teenagers and their nuclear families, so that the extended family, in turn, can provide the personal support necessary in each situation. More than anything else, what young people from non-traditional families need are roots into an extended Christian family that will be there for them. Not simply a team of zany youth workers who provide short-term intimacy with long-term support. And again, I need to remind you, I am a recovering zany youth ministry. I'm not a professor that is saying this is what you people who are crazy and wild and crazy with kids ought to be doing. I still think there's a place for us to have fun and do wild and outrageous things with kids. But the bottom line is we got to recognize that the power, the long-term impact of our program is not in our personalities. And it's not even in our programming. It is in how effective we are at connecting these kids with their own cloud of witnesses, surrounding them in a way that that they can grow to maturity in Christ. I'm reminded of the company that went from making millions in profit one year to bankruptcy the next. The board of directors was puzzled, wondering, we've done exactly the same thing that put us on top of the industry last year. What happened this year? What happened was not caused by anything within the company. It had always run a great business, making and selling bobby pins. But when the culture changed around them and hairstyles no longer required bobby pins, this company simply kept doing what it had always done. Because of a vision that was too small, the company folded. As we approach the turn of the century, our world is undergoing enormous change. Families are changing. The teenagers we work with are becoming a new breed, different from any before them. The question is, will our vision be large enough to meet those changes? Or will we wind up like the board of directors, scratching our heads and wondering why doing what we've always done has left our ministries bankrupt? Well, a few implications for ministry as we think about non-traditional families. First, because most young people from non-traditional families tend to fall through the cracks of a traditional youth ministry, ensuring that someone is available to administer the trivial task of keeping an accurate list of students' names, current addresses, and phone numbers is absolutely essential. Two, every young person needs contact from caring adults, but most teenagers from non-traditional families have an acute need for this kind of contact. The pastor or youth pastor can create a system in which each young person is contacted at least once every 6 months, or simply to check in. The caller is sure to gain information about the family that would otherwise not be learned until the church's next stewardship drive, right? If children from non-traditional families are 2 to 6 times more likely to stay uninvolved in our programs, perhaps God is calling us to give 2 to 6 times the amount of effort to reach them as we do to those who naturally connect with the church. Number 3. It is crucial that young people from non-traditional families feel a part of the entire church and not simply a part of the youth program. And I hope you see that. They, more than any group, need to have a lifelong connection because in many ways they often feel orphaned. They need to have a connection with this lifelong structure, not another structure that will orphan them when they graduate from high school. Here are a few ideas to build this kind of connection. Youth leaders can sit with students during worship on Sunday morning in the big church. Youth leaders or other adults in the church can invite a teenager to all church fellowship events, for example, Wednesday night dinners. Adults in the church can invite teenagers to serve with them in local or out-of-town mission projects. All right. Number 4. We can design publicity for our programs in such a way that people from non-traditional families get a personal invitation, a phone call, or some extra reminder about the event. And then the wild hair. Cancel all your youth activities. Sunday school, youth group, special events, Bible studies, retreats, everything for 1 month. And during that month, have the youth leader visit every young person in the church. Well, we've now addressed what we see as the unique challenges to working with families and the unique challenges of the non-traditional families in this culture. We've identified the two most powerful sources for leading kids to faith maturity: the nuclear family doing the work of Christian nurture, and the extended family of the church, often stepping in and standing in the gap, doing the work of Christian nurture when the nuclear family is not doing that. The next question I'm often asked is, okay, what about if we're saying we need to connect kids with adults? What about kids' developmental need for independence? Isn't that part of what God designed them for, to step away from their families and other adults? Well, that's what our next lecture will be about in the next tape. It's entitled Walking the Tightrope, and we're going to talk about how do we affirm kids' need for independence or individuation, and at the same time provide them with connections with significant adult lifelong continuity, structures of continuity. Okay? You can fast forward this tape to the end so that when the next person listens to it, it'll be ready to go.